Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Line for May 31st, 2015. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me again this week, welcome Tim Shiflett.
Well, good evening, sir.
Yes, just you back again this weekend. We believe that Catherine will return from her European vacation next Sunday. Be glad to have her back. But Tim and I think we did last week, did a good job holding on the fort, going to do it again. Tonight, in about 20 minutes, Del Cardwell of Trust Del will be coming on. That's the Trust Del radio show, the television program, the website, the mini billboards, and everything else. Del's, for one time, was a very frequent guest of our show. He ran for Senate in Georgia back in 2008. He was on kind of as part of that run. He came on some after. He was the consumer investigative reporter for WSB, probably the, I guess, wouldn't you say the largest local affiliate in the South, really? Right, Tim?
Oh, WSB, absolutely. They have a huge viewing audience, and they get a large share of the action down there in Atlanta, easily the largest affiliate. TV-wise, in the South.
Yeah, I mean, and not just Atlanta, but you know, Atlanta's one of the biggest cities in the South, and had such a range of area because you didn't have cities around it that would have their own television stations. Atlanta, I think, goes all the way. Like, I would go to my great-grandmother's house in Waycross, which, if you're not familiar, that's close to Jacksonville. And you'd have a lot of TV stations from Jacksonville and maybe some from Savannah, that kind of stuff. For whatever reason, Channel 2 WSB, the ABC affiliate, would be what you'd get for ABC. You'd still get it from
Ohio. They've always been the Cadillac station down there. They've had the big name announcers like Monica Kaufman and some of those people, and they have a huge following. If I'm going to watch local news in Atlanta, that's who I'm going to watch, and of course that's where our guest tonight first came to prominence. So,
yeah, and you mentioned Monica Kaufman. One time I heard something, you know, it was a part of Del's run. When people knew her first and foremost on that station, I believe the male anchor, John Pruitt, was number two, and then Del was number three on that station. He was ahead of the weatherman, ahead of the sportsman. He actually was only third to the two anchors, which, I mean, they spend more face time, so that makes sense. But some of those anchors we talked about, they're retired, Dollandale, still going strong with his multi-city state network, but we'll get into that. But let's kind of talk about the biggest story of the weekend and also really the saddest story of the weekend. Yesterday, Delaware Attorney General, planning to run for governor and son of the Vice President, Beau Biden, died of brain cancer. I think the fact that he was not 100%, so to speak, was known. I don't know that people knew the extent of his illness until yesterday. Tim, were there whispers, or is that kind of just or do they kind of keep it quiet, if you will?
No, it seemed like they kept it quiet. Now, he's always been known for the last, close to a decade, I guess, as someone who's had some health problems. He had a stroke, I believe, 5 years ago. And he's had this problem, he's had that problem. But apparently, according to what everybody thought, you know, he was going to be gearing up to run for governor up there. And this just hit everybody like a ton of bricks. It's really sad. He actually had a lot of tragedy in his life. Of course, we know the story of the car wreck right after his father was elected to the Senate in 1972, and his mother and younger sister were killed in that wreck. And there's a very famous picture that was taken by the wire services of his father being sworn into the Senate, and Bo was laying there in a hospital bed as a 3-year-old, watching it, injuries from the wreck. So it's really a sad thing. He could have been governor, I think he would have been, or maybe he would have eventually followed his father into the U.S. Senate. So it's really sad.
Yeah, and that, you know, you mentioned his life being sad. Obviously, his father's had one of the saddest tales. I think I saw somewhere people said, you know, maybe after the Kennedy family, Joe Biden's doing more than anybody else was. Two children he's going to have to bury, and his wife. A lot to go through. Which still Joe Biden seems to be an upbeat person. And just a testament to his resilience. And maybe that's one reason why people seem to like Joe Biden. Even people that don't agree with Joe Biden politically seem to, have a they like him, if you will. It's that, you know, beer likability test.
David, all those years that he was in the Senate, when Bo and the other surviving children were small, he would get on the train every day, conclusion of business in the Senate, and go home to Delaware. I don't know, it's about a 90-minute trip, I think, by train, something like that up there, just to give those kids the semblance of a normal home. Always thought that was a touching aspect of a guy like Joe Biden, and I think that's why he always has kept that reputation as kind of the guy next door type, the guy that works in the factory, or he's just your neighbor down the street that owns the grocery store. That's the kind of impression Joe Biden always gave me, wouldn't you think so?
Yes, I know what you mean. Even though he rose to the Senate so young,
yep.
I guess he was still... Well, I mean, early 30s or was it late 20s?
He had not had his 30th birthday yet when he got elected, but he was 30 by the time he took office.
Yeah, kind of the in-between time. So you could say it either way if you wanted to read it either way, but right at 30, to be exact. Well, let's kind of switch gears. And something that's been on the radar for us, and we just never get to it, but that's why I put it towards the front of the show, would be the West Virginia governor's race. And it doesn't come up for another year or two, but there's a lot of talk of several things. Joe Manchin being the state's junior senator, I guess, if you will. There was thought that he may not like Washington that much because he seems, by all accounts, to seem to be the most conservative Democrat in the U.S. Senate. And so it kind of puts him in kind of a lonely place at times, because he's one of those guys that used to could have found people on the other side of the aisle to vote with, but he has to go way over on the other side of the aisle to get with the core of the Republican Party. And then at the same time, there's not as many moderate Democrats. And so the parties have kind of moved to the left and the right, to be fair. They've moved each way. And somebody that's kind of a blue dog is, or even a moderate Republican for that matter, they're kind of a endangered species. So people thought, well, he might go back to the governor's mansion where he could maybe be a little more comfortable being who he is. We decided not to. So that kind of left the Democrats a little bit of a hole. Even though the state minority leader, Jeff Kessler, has already entered the race, he was the head of the state Senate when the Democrats were in control. I'm not sure the exact year when they lost control, but one would think, 2010, 2014, both possible years that were not good for Democrats that would have been possible takeover years. Also, West Virginia was one of those states that actually didn't do as well as Democrats did other places when presidential years. So that complicated matters. Earl Ray Tomlin, he's the Democratic incumbent. He's term limited. And so, kind of looking like, where would they go? Well, Jim Justice, who is the wealthiest man in the state has decided he wants to run for governor as a Democrat. And it's really an interesting fit. If you look at the fact that he made his money through coal, and a lot of people believe one reason that West Virginia has gone so Republican lately is because of coal. They see that, you know, regulation, environmentalism, different things that are more Democratic issues, people, you know, think that coal conflicts with it. Not necessarily all coal mining, but certainly mountaintop removal, coal mining, surface mining, things like that. I don't know how Jim Justice made his coal mining money. I don't know if he did deep mining or if he's involved in some of the, you know, clear cutting or, you know, mountaintop removal, things like that. But he's going to run as a Democrat. At the same time, he also owns big resorts in the state, and there you want to keep the beauty of the state. You know, you knock all the tops of the mountains, I'm not so sure people want to come stay and see the resorts, if you will, that are in the mountainous area. So he's kind of in both, you know, sides of West Virginia's heritage. What do you know about Jim Justice, Tim?
I know, of course, he's already announced he's going to self-finance, which is no surprise. He's the richest man in the state up there. He owns that resort. The name of it escapes me now. I can't believe I can't remember it. But it's that resort that's got the hidden area underneath it where the U.S. House and all that were going to go in case of nuclear attack. Now they've opened up that area as a museum, and it's one of the most exclusive resorts in the state and very popular and makes a lot of money. You know, I don't believe he's ever sought political office before, so he's just kind of jumped in there out of nowhere, almost as if he was wanting to jump in something of a void after Senator Manchin decided not to run for the Senate or for governor rather. And by the way, National Committee breathed a sigh of relief on that one, didn't they? Because that makes it highly likely that the Democrats are going to keep that Senate seat, whereas they probably would have lost it. Wouldn't you think so?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. It'll be a test of how far right. The state's moved. It'll be interesting to see what happens on the coal policy. I mean, maybe if he is still one of the miners that does the deep mining, the traditional, you know, you dig a hole in the mountain and you go in and you still preserve the mountain, maybe some of the people that want to do it the quick way, which I've heard a lot of that's the Russian and Chinese-backed companies. It's not necessarily local West Virginians. It could be an interesting thing where maybe he can turn some people's minds against that mountaintop removal in West Virginia, at least more of the people, you know, that, you know, not wanting to sell the land and things like that.
No matter what type of mining he does, how can the Republicans attack him on this when West Virginia is a hardcore coal state? If you're a politician in that state, you had better be a supporter of coal. Because that's the livelihood of so many people, you're not going to get anywhere. So how could the Republicans attack him in any way, shape, or form?
Yeah, I think that's just nuanced difference. I mean, if you think that we're going to immediately get off of all coal production, that's unrealistic in the short term. But if you think that we have to have mountaintop removal, I don't think you have to. I think we've been mining it other ways.
I agree with you, but even if Jim Justice has been involved in that sort of thing, my question is, how could the Republicans attack him on it when every one of them would be for the same thing up there?
Oh, well, no, they couldn't attack him on it. That would just say, hey, you're with those, you know, those Democrats, and that's how they want to, you know, ban all that. Although I've heard, you know, of course, when you do that, it gets in the water system. It contaminates the water system when you have all that sludge
go down the streams, because obviously where you have mountains, you have streams, you know, that changes, you know, the facet of everything. So be interesting to see. One thing, while we were doing research on him, I think I shot y'all an article about Jim Justice that was on ESPN. Even though he's this, you know, multi-billionaire, he decided he wanted to coach a girls' basketball team, public school up there in West Virginia, and quite successful. And I think now something happened at the school where he said, hey, I don't, you know, I don't have teaching responsibilities, and he may have to back off from this, obviously, from this year and then from then on if he's the governor. But he coached both teams for a little while. So he's the kind of guy that gives back, if you will. He's not hey, there's something real to him. What did you think of those articles, Tim?
Well, you know, let me say this about Justice in particular. I mean, we're talking about him like he's already got the nomination. That's not necessarily so when you've got Kessler running, who is a state senator. He was the first declared candidate. There are others out there talking about running, and a bunch of them on the Republican side. So I think a lot of people would prefer that Justice did run, because he can pay his own way. You always like to have that type of candidate, regardless of what you hear about him or this or that or the other. If they can pay their own way, they can go a long way. So.
Yeah. Greenbrier is the name of the resort.
Greenbrier,
they have a big golf tournament. They're advertising that Tiger Woods is going to come be at their golf tournament. They're having a concert series, what looks like some of the bigger country stars, if you will, Blake Shelton and Keith Urban. They have a health program. I don't know if that's like a weight loss thing or what, but this, you know, this hotel, I guess they show, looks like a small White House, if you will. So,
And David, some of the polling, early polling I've seen on this race, testing different candidates, including Kessler and some of the others, it appears that on average the Republicans might be slightly favored as their candidates run anywhere from 2 to 6 points ahead of the Democratic candidates, but nobody is even approaching 45% in any of this polling. There's still about a 28 to 30% undecided. Like I said, a lot of Republicans are looking at this race, including a couple of Congress critters, and hey, even Mary Lou Retton's name has been mentioned. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, and obviously, I mean, they've got, the Republicans do have, you know, several announced candidates that are probably going to be strong. I think this is going to be those interesting races. The poll, it may not get as many polls because it doesn't have a Senate. Well, it didn't have the Senate races the same way. You know, they don't have another one. It's still 2018. And so with it just being a governor's race, it's only going to get the, you know, the local media market.
The thing is, though, it might be actually more interesting to poll it now, because let's face it, if Manchin had run for governor, I think he was a pretty clear favorite. A lot of big-name Republicans would have stepped away from this race and perhaps sought his Senate seat or something like that. But with the thing being wide open now, like I said, now we've got U.S. congressmen looking at this race up there and stuff like that. So it's anybody's race, and a guy like this Justice just makes it more interesting with the fact that he just, you know, has a king's ransom at his beckoning call. I mean, in West Virginia, what would you say if you could spend $5 or $6 million? Why, you approach the law of diminishing returns right there, because it shouldn't be that expensive.
Oh yeah, and it'd be interesting to see, because this is going to be an election in a presidential year, and it's going to be a test to see how much. This is a state where Hillary Clinton may do significantly better than President Obama. Maybe not. Maybe it is the coal thing, and Democrats are bad. But then, you know, in the West Virginia's eyes now. But you have to be thinking, well, maybe this is going to be a state where it doesn't really return exactly to the Democratic roots, but it comes closer. Obviously, Jim, you know, the Democratic nominee, you know, holds the governor's mansion. Another interesting race, District 3, Earl Ray Tomlin has been being recruited to face Evan Jenkins in the 3rd District. You would think a sitting governor, pretty popular, he wins that race, then the Democrats actually have a seat in the Congress, and right now they hold
Guess what? You just mentioned Evan Jenkins. He's one of those congressmen that's being mentioned as possibly moving up to run for governor. Then that means that his seat tied open. And gosh, Earl Ray Tomlin could just waltz right into that seat and we could pick up a House seat right there.
Yeah, and that's where we're going to pick them up, is things like that. Although it's something else to think about, that West Virginia's delegation has one Democratic senator, one Republican senator, and 3 Republican congressmen. I mean, West Virginia used to be one of the most reliable Democratic states, and that has a lot to do with, I guess,
and
unions
Vermont
in the past.
Well, used to be a reliable Republican, you know, place, too, but things do change. The map has changed some over the years, and it certainly changed in West Virginia. It's gone as red as it can go.
Certainly so. Well, let me go ahead and bring on our guest. Welcome back to the show. First time in a while, but certainly not the first time. Dale Cardwell. Welcome, Dale.
How are you, David? How are you, Tim?
Good evening.
Yeah.
It's good to be here.
Yes, it's good to have you back. And, Dale, we used to have you on so frequently to talk about political things. We may get into a little politics. But I think I'm not sure if you've been on since you started up Trust Dale, but it was in its infancy. If so, kind of tell our listeners what's going on with Trust Dale.
Well, thank you, David. You know, back in 2009, when I finished my campaign in 2008, I really didn't want to go back to conventional journalism. I didn't want to go back to, frankly, the blood and guts of television news. And I wanted to continue trying to find a way to help people. I moved to Atlanta in 1995 to work with Clark Howard in the consumer unit at Channel 2. And I decided that I was going to create an opportunity for people to make smart buying decisions based on a 7-point investigative analysis that proves that a company that claims to be excellent, that claims to do really great work in price, quality, and customer service, they actually are delivering that. And so I applied an investigative theory to proving those companies were putting up what they claimed they were doing. And so I launched TrustDale.com and I believe, David, that it's proven itself to be worthy, but we want an easy way to make a tough buying decision. But it's not easy unless it's credible. But if you can base that recommendation in credibility, then it seems to work.
Yes. And I guess when you started out, obviously an online presence came early on, but you started with your TV show. And at the time, I want to say the first time I saw it was on Channel 11. You moved around on the Atlanta market. You're on 46. You're also on Peachtree TV, and I'm going to ask you a question about that. Just the TV side of things.
Well, you know, I realized that if I was going to tell people, you know, that they could trust a plumber or a roofer or a painter, I needed to base that credibility in actually investigating bad companies. Because what I found over the years, guys, is that 95% of the people that get burned in a buying decision, they're burned because they are trying to get something for nothing. They take the bait of someone who claims that they can provide a 50 or 60% discount on a product or a service. And then the second thing is they hire a company that has no findable office. And that company has no because they don't want to be found. And so in order to prove that I knew how to get to the bottom of things, I just felt like I needed to have a television show and a radio show that focused on solving problems. that didn't focus on selling stuff, but focused on helping people solve their consumer problems. So today I get about 150 emails every day from consumers in five states where our television show airs, and we basically take the best case scenarios of how we can teach a lesson from those consumer problems, and we solve them. We find the perpetrator who did something that they shouldn't have done, and we mediate problems and essentially try to teach lessons. And so I really enjoy doing that.
Yeah, I'm going to pass it to Tim here in a second for questions. But before that, Peachtree TV, now that used to be called TBS. Now we know TBS broke away, and it's more of a national cable channel. Peachtree TV, I still, I guess, see it as a cable channel because I have a Dish, and if you had Comcast or whatever, you'd still get it on there, and I guess you could get it with Rabbit Ears on 17. But is Peachtree TV actually shown outside of Georgia? Is that, can you get that across the South, say?
I don't think so, David. I think it's still on a few cable systems. But what happened is Peachtree TV is managed by Meredith. And Meredith, which owns Channel 46 and Channel 4 in Nashville, I happen to have used to work there, and KPHO in Phoenix. For some reason, Meredith manages Peachtree TV. And when Meredith approached me and they wanted me to move my television show to Channel 46, they also said, hey, it would be a great opportunity for you to be on Peachtree TV. We've got a good audience that watches this channel, and it's very low on the cable. You know, it's generally Channel 2 on most people's cable systems. So it's a great sister station for my show to be on.
Yeah, well, what should he do is get wrestling back on and the TBS studios on old Channel 17. You have a great lead in there. Well,
maybe get Bill Tush back on. That would be great.
There we go.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to pass it over to Tim for some questions. Tim?
Sure.
Good evening, Dale. It's good to talk to you again, my friend. How are you?
I'm great, Tim. What is it? A great sound for sore ears. It's nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, really. Look, you got a lot of services listed now on your website that you help people with. Which of those would you say is the most popular for consumers to ask you about and why?
Tim, I think it's the emergency services. I think it's when somebody needs help immediately and they don't know where to turn. And if you followed the analytics of my website, you'd find that the plumbers get calls more often than anyone else. The roofers get a lot of calls. And I think it's because when people have to make a tough buying decision, they generally don't trust their own judgment. They want somebody to help them make that decision. And I think the reason that they come to my site is because I show the research on the site. I don't just tell people they can trust a company. I say, here's why. And they can read about the company. They can watch a video that explains what the company does and how they do it. And it just gives them peace of mind when they make that buying decision. I think that's the key to it.
Now, you know, the companies we're talking about here, I mean, you've dealt with this type of company for 20 years. Do you still find a lot of disreputable services out there?
I do, Tim, but what's amazing, 149 of the 150 emails I get a day are about companies that I don't recommend. They're about someone who took a chance on a company that doesn't have liability insurance, that has a record of getting sued in small claims court, a company that has a very bad reputation online. The problem is the consumer didn't take the time to do a little bit of research to find out if that company is a reputable company. And again, the common denominator of people really, really want to take a chance on a company who claims that they can provide the service for 50, 60, 70% less than the going rate. That's really the common denominator of how somebody makes a bad decision.
Yeah. Now, obviously, your flagship thing has been your TV show. We watch it a lot, by the way, at work. just wanted you to know that you've got
Thank
a kind of a devoted audience there. Do you get a lot of traffic also on the internet, or is it mostly television?
You know, Tim, it's amazing. It's actually mostly the internet. I have about 25,000 visits a month, but about 80 some odd thousand page visits. In other words, consumers are visiting companies on my website to the amount of 80,000 visits a month. And it, essentially, that's the core of the business. And
mm-hmm.
the television show does pretty well. I have, in every market, we're in Atlanta, Birmingham, Dallas-Fort Worth, Nashville, and Tampa. And the TV show averages 30 to 50,000 households watching the TV show every time it's on. But what we try to do is say, folks, this is a TV show that shows you how people went the wrong path. If you'll come to the website, you'll find a really easy way to make a smart buying decision. And, you know, the thing is, when I started it, I was really concerned that I would be a very busy guy constantly having to fix problems that just evolved because people are human. But it turns out that over the past 5.5 years, I've sent out about 500,000 recommendations through the mm-hmm. website that I can measure through the website. I have literally only had to fix 7 problems. In other words, now, I mediate a lot. I will get involved,
uh-huh.
and my team will get involved, but when I've actually had to pick up the phone and call a company and say, Joe, you got to fix this, and, you know, and basically force the company to fix it 7 times. And the key is, if you choose really good companies on the front end, you have very few problems on the back end.
Oh, makes sense. And with that, I'm going to pass it back to David.
Yes, well, since we're on online radio podcasting, we know that you've also started a radio show, and just knowing the nature of your services, it lends itself really well to radio. And you look at some of your stations and your time slots, I mean, you couldn't get a much better time slot than in Atlanta, 5 o'clock drive time on 640. In Tampa, you've got a good, you know, 11 a.m., not a bedtime slot at all during the week, and you're on iHeartRadio. How's the radio show going?
It's going really well. I tell you, David, part of the blessing of it for me is that it's 1 hour. So I'm not having to come up with content that will fill more than 1 hour. So our premise is we try to solve 2 consumer problems per show with a real email or a real phone call in the first 30 minutes, and we switch subjects into the second half hour of the show. And it's people get a result in 30 minutes, and that's what I think that's the key to the success of the show. Today, people want results. They just want to know that things can be solved. And so whether it's in, you know, I'm very happy to say that we've got a 5 a.m. Show slot in Dallas, Fort Worth, which is really early in the morning. But, you know, guys, there's a lot of people on the road from 5 to 6 a.m. And so, and we've got 7 a.m. in Nashville on WLAC. So the challenge is making certain that we have content that those people in all those cities want to listen to. But, you know, Tim and David, when you've been burned and you need help because someone took advantage of you, whether it's roofing, window replacement, those kinds of problems are consistent city to city to city. People get burned the same way. And so if they can learn how to avoid getting burned, that's good content.
Yeah. And on iHeartRadio, I think when that first came about, no one, you know, much gave it any attention. But I know a lot of people just play that all the time because it is on the internet. It streams. It's kind of the internet when you're at a computer version of Sirius, if you will. Have you seen a lot of uptick in contacts since you got on iHeartRadio?
Without a doubt. In fact, our shows are listened to about 150 times a day from people that are going back and wanting to listen to content from previous shows. And, you know, and guys, I can tell you there have been many times that I've gone back and listened to your show, thankfully, because I can you can research previously aired episodes. And that's a wonderful resource that people don't have to always catch it live. Because there's an archive, and you can go back and listen to it.
Oh, yes. Well, as we're looking at your website for, you know, doing a little research, I noticed that you have the Children's Village at Christian City. It's kind of something that you're not making any money off of. There's no commercial interest whatsoever. It's kind of your charitable interest. How did you get involved with that, and you can tell the people about it?
Well, it's a funny story. Back in 2007, I got a call from none other than Truett Cathy, and the founder of Chick-fil-A. And I had met him through mutual friends, and he was upset because the state of Georgia had taken some action to shut down group homes. And Truett Cathy had placed group homes all over the state, and he was very upset about it, and he needed my help. He wanted to tell his story about how many kids that he had helped by having children have a home in a group home. And the state of Georgia was well-intended. They wanted children to be placed into, you know, homes that were not group homes, but mom-and-pop homes. And that's fine. The problem is there's just not enough of them. And so I met Truett Cathy and befriended him through doing a story on Channel 2 about his desire to be able to promote the idea of group homes. And the state finally came around and frankly did the right thing in that regard, but it created a friendship between Mr. Cathy and myself. And then a few years ago, before his death, he called me up and said, "Bill, I've got a charity that's near and dear to my heart, but my plate is full. I've got a lot of responsibility with a lot of different things." And he said, "I would really, really appreciate it if you would champion this." And guys, you know, if Truett Cathy asked you to do something like that, you can't say no. And so I went down, I investigated it. I took a look at their tax returns. I found that an overwhelming majority of their money that they receive goes toward those supporting those kids in those homes. And we've been doing it ever since. And we do a golf tournament every year. The first year, we literally raised $500,000 and built a new group home for children there at Children's Village. And it's just a wonderful thing to be involved in. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell people about it. If you visit Truttdale.com, you'll see a link to help Children's Village right on our homepage.
Yes. I think Truett Cathy actually supported at least one group home at Windshape at Barry, which is from where I live and a little further from Tim. But the way the group home that I'm familiar with is there is a mother and a father that run it, and that's kind of their job. And then mm-hmm. they have their own biological children, and then they have maybe as many as 8 to 10 more kids. And so they do kind of raise it like a family, but then it's technically, I guess, a group home. So it's all in how it works out. I mean, yeah, if everybody's doing shift work all day long, it has one feel. But then if you can set it up where there is a structured, you know, set of folks, wouldn't have to be, I guess, necessarily a married man and woman or anything. It could be other folks, but they were there all the time, like a parent would be. Still technically a group home, but then would have the positives of a family, if you will, like the state was looking.
David, I agree. David, I think it's just for those kids to be able to come home and feel some responsibility to a unit and some accountability. I think that adds an ingredient that is missing in some other facilities. And if these kids feel as though somebody cares about them, then that's a huge plus. And Children's Village has had an amazing track record. I mean, they've been around for more than a half a century. And there are a lot of very successful people all over the United States that call Children's Village home.
Yes, well, since we got you on the line and you're visiting all these cities across the South, it seems like we can get political or civic, if you will. And we know you know Atlanta as well as anybody because obviously consumer affairs, you had to go all over the city of Atlanta, all over the metro area, but now you're going to go through Dallas, Nashville, Birmingham, Tampa. What are you seeing in some of these other cities compared to Atlanta? Like, what's better, what's worse, what's some things different cities can learn from? Like, I've been to, I guess, all those cities that you're in fairly recently. I've never been to Dallas before, but I'm just sprawling. Atlanta and sprawling. Dallas seems to be even more, if you will, and I was surprised by that. But what are some things, some lessons, if you will?
Well, what I learned is that when you have conflict, political conflict, and that the city seems to be, or the core of the government is run by one demographic organization, doesn't matter if it's white or black or Latino or whatever, but if you have the driving force is what's the word I'm looking for? It's just one, and you can't get the cooperation. It's very difficult. Let me put it this way: Dallas, Texas, it's amazing. It's a boom town, and I told you, David, as we were talking, is that when you drive through Dallas and you see that the interstate is full, well, what they do is they just build another road on top of it. There are interstates there that are 3 and 5 stories high. And you come back to Atlanta, and you see that, well, gee, you know, we're still riding on roads that were here 30 years ago. And I find a paralysis, because I think we've reached a point where the public simply doesn't trust the leadership to spend the money wisely. And it's a sad state of affairs, and I don't know how we fix that. Nashville, again, you've got a government that basically one party runs Nashville, one party runs Dallas, and it's essentially they do what they want to do. And in the long run, I'm not quite sure if that's going to be the best for the region, but they seem to be able to get things done because of that. I think Atlanta is stuck in a paralysis because the city is run by one demographic, and then the state is run by a different demographic, and those two organizations don't cooperate with each other.
Yeah. Well, Tim, any questions for Dale on some of these other cities, and we can kind of get more political if you want.
Yeah. Is Atlanta still your busiest area? We talk about the large cities. Is Atlanta still your busiest area as far as hearing from consumers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Tim. You know, it's interesting. People say, why would TrustDale.com work in a city that you've never been a reporter? And that's a valid question. And what I did is, after I'd been in Tampa for 18 months, I've now been there for almost 2 years, but I measured my analytics. In other words, when someone comes to TrustDale.com in Tampa, what is the likelihood that they are actually going to pick up the phone and call a company that I recommend? Well, in Atlanta, 38% of the people that visit the website actually pick up the phone and call a company while they're on my website. And that's that's an extraordinarily high number of people. The average website for a plumber, a roofer, a painter, an electrician, they hope to capture and convert maybe 5% of the people who land on their page and get those people to call them. My average is 38%. And I think it's because I'm capturing people very late in the buying cycle. They need to make a decision, and they just want to have somebody they can trust. Well, in Tampa, after I'd been there for 18 months, I measured the same, what we call an impression to a conversion ratio, and the ratio is 37% in Tampa. And while the volume of visits to the website are not as great as they are in Atlanta, the result is essentially the same. And we're finding that same trend now in Dallas, Fort Worth, and in Birmingham and Nashville. So it keeps me pretty busy.
And do you find that the folks in all these cities essentially ask about the same things, or is there something different in some of these cities that might be, say, just unique to that area?
Well, I'll tell you, Tampa is a collection of three smaller boroughs. You've got Hillsborough County, Pinellas County, and Sarasota. And those three areas are separated by very long bridges that span, a lot of water. And what happens is the companies really don't want to serve the entire metropolitan area, because if there's a wreck on the bridge, then it just completely shuts down commerce. And they're going to lose a lot of money if they get stuck on that bridge. So you'll find that companies want to just serve the geographical area in their county, whereas Atlanta, Dallas, Fort Worth, Nashville, the metropolitan areas really don't have any boundaries. And people, the companies will serve very, very large areas. I have learned, Tim and David, that if you live in Rome, or if you live in Athens, or you live in Atlanta, and you've been here for 30 years, chances are you have a neighborhood plumber or a neighborhood electrician that has served your neighborhood for 30 years. And that person, if they're not interested in growing their business to become a giant plumber, you can get very competitive rates and good service from that local neighborhood plumber. And the problem is that Atlanta is such a transitory city that most people don't have a resource like that. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to help people make a tough buying decision based on the fact that I know that this plumber has a business license. I know they're a real plumber. They actually have a plumbing license, and I have seen that license. I know that they have a great record, and they don't get sued in small claims court. What I'm essentially trying to do is give the consumer confidence when they pick up the phone and call somebody. So, because at the end of the day, when you're working, you stay home from work for a half day because you had to have somebody come out and fix your air conditioning system. You don't want to have to take a second day because they didn't do it right. That's really what I'm trying to do, is make people, give people a smoother experience.
All right. Yes. And to get us started in some political stuff.
Yeah, well, Dale, we know that you're trying to serve everybody, so we don't have to make you too partisan. But I'm sure you follow the presidential race in the early stages. A ton of Republican candidates. There's so many. Do you think a certain one may break out, or are there some that might just drop out? Or what's your take on presidential race so far?
Now, obviously, guys, I'm fascinated by it. And I'm amazed how many Republicans have come up and thrown their hat in the ring. Essentially, because the trend of our political system is moving toward a much more pluralistic society, and the common denominator for all of those Republicans is the white male that is becoming a smaller and smaller population center in the United States. And I think we saw in the last cycle that, you know, there was a lot of people that believed that Romney could win. And we saw, as the election continued to, you know, move forward, that the base was not there. And so I'm really surprised that there are so many people that are entering the race despite the demographic evidence of where the country is going. I think we have to have a leader that can pull people together and start finding common denominators of what we need to move the country forward and not divide the country. And, you know, I you gentlemen probably listened to some of John Kasich, I believe the governor, former governor of Ohio. It's an interesting rhetoric if you listen to him. He's talking about empathy, and he's talking about, you know, as you know, what he did with healthcare in Ohio. Is that he believed in and supported the ability to have Medicaid expand in Ohio, and then he came into Atlanta and Georgia, and he did a sweep through here. I don't think Georgia's ready for that, but it's refreshing to hear somebody bring that kind of conversation back into the marketplace of ideas.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a Republican consultant that will, you know, say, yeah, look how he supported Obamacare, and, you know, that'll be the death knell for him for actually trying to move a little more to the middle and move folks together. You were talking about the white male, and the male part of that is interesting when you talk about the Republican primary. You've got
all these candidates, and you only have one female in the race, Carly Farina, and she's never held elective office. I'm just really surprised that more elected officials, and there are Republican female elected officials, are not looking at this race. Dale, any idea why there isn't one of those either elected officials or former elected officials that are female and Republican seeking office?
You know, I mean, guys, you know how I am. I think that the problem is money. And when I ran in 2007 and 2008, I ran because I was convinced that our system had been hijacked by people who are willing to pay for people to run for office. And then when you win office, you're required to serve those interests. So I think that people that run have to have a constituency that's already built in. They have to know where they can go get the money. And, you know, you hear all these candidates talking about running, and several of them have not committed yet. And, you know, and the reason they have not committed is because they cannot analytically be for certain that they can raise the money that's required. And, you know, I think that's the tragedy of our system today, is that essentially the media, you know, I'll tell you what I find fascinating is the first Republican debates on Fox News and CNN. And Fox News has now said, we're going to take the top 10, I believe is what it is. It may be five, but we're going to basically look at the poll and see who's leading the poll. And the first round is only going to be that's going to essentially exclude any of the people that Fox News has decided is not a viable candidate. And guys, I think that's a scary precedent. That's a frightening precedent when you've got a quasi news media. I don't really think of Fox as a news media, but when you see a news medium determining who your candidates are as opposed to reflecting who the candidates are, that's scary to me.
Yeah, and it'll also affect the process, because you would have to, if you were, let's say, number 11, number 12, you'd say, hey, I've got to spend more of my money just to raise my poll numbers to then get to be in the debate and try to get to, say, 9 to get on the debate. Tim, any questions
exactly.
Politically, Dale?
Yeah, you ran a pretty good race yourself, Dale, back in 2008. By the way, David, did I mention to you this week that Dale won my county? But
not this week.
Anyway, Dale, I've got to ask this. Have any other people asked you, you know, if you were ever interested in getting back into the political fray, seeking another office, anything like that?
A little bit, Tim. But what I find interesting is that I, as you well know, I said, guys, I'm not taking PAC money. And I can't do it because I think that that is the problem, which doesn't matter which side of the aisle you're on. That's the essential problem of our system. And when I rejected that system, the money trail of the way you run, I think I pretty much sealed my fate. People said to me, Dale, if you're going to reject the path that people have to take to run for office, then there's no path for you. And I think that's pretty much true. You know, my wife would shoot me if she heard me say that I would consider running again. But I think the only way I could is if I could self-fund. I am so convinced that the problem on a state and national level is the fact that you've got to do what's in the best interest of the people, not what's in the best interest of the people who paid your way to get there.
Yeah. You know, you told me that same thing 7 years ago in a restaurant in Rome. I'm glad to see that you have stuck right to your guns on that point. And with that, I'm going to throw it back over to David to close this out.
Yeah, well, Dale, we thank you for coming on the show. Is there anything you want to share with our listeners before we let you off here? A new city, a new time slot, anything like that you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm really excited, David, to say that I'm about to be able to expand TrustDale.com to cities in Georgia that are outside the principal metropolitan area of Atlanta. We're moving into Athens and Rome and LaGrange and Macon. And what I tell people, and part of life is a process. And when people say, Dale, you're representing companies and there are 400 companies on your website in five cities, how do I know that those companies are excellent and they're just not paying you to say that they're excellent? And I can say, you know, Tim, 7 years after the run for the Senate, I say to these people, if I could not be bought and my position could not be influenced by money under those circumstances, then today I can't be bought either. I choose the company that I represent on my website. The company does not choose me. And the good news for the consumer is that it's free. They don't pay me a penny to follow the advice that I give them on the website. Plus, they get a guarantee that they're going to have a good experience. So life is a process. It's an evolution. And I'm really, really happy to be where I am today. And I'm very, very grateful for you gentlemen, for your support over the years and your friendship, because I've really enjoyed it and I've enjoyed being on the radio show.
Yeah, well, Dale, we thank you for coming on again, and we're going to keep monitoring your progress on all the media sources that you're on.
Well, thank you so much. And David, I appreciate the invitation, and best of luck to you gentlemen. You provide a great service for people.
And Dale, it's always good to hear from you again, my friend. We'll see you on the Internet.
Fantastic. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, David.
Yes. Well, good to have Dale Cardwell on. You know, Tim, I thought it was kind of funny that he said, you know, an hour is just a really good amount of time for a radio show. And I was like, I wonder where he got that idea from. never think. Well, we've got minute or two. Yeah, we got about 2 minutes left, and the hour we like named for. Once again, I'm opening that time window up so I don't get cut off again. But there was a new poll that Bloomberg conducted of Iowa, and this is kind of a more important poll because if somebody does horrible in Iowa, it's going to hurt them. If somebody does great in Iowa, it's going to help them. And it tested a ton of candidates. And Scott Walker came out ahead in this poll. And I think if I had to say a front runner for this race, I would say, you know, Scott Walker is the front runner. He did well. Jeb Bush was, you know, he was up there a good bit. Ben Carson, there is some there, if you will. He's actually holding his numbers further than the flavor of the month, which I think some folks thought he was. What are some of your takeaways from the poll?
Well, it was conducted in conjunction with the Des Moines Register, and Walker does have a 7-point lead. There's a whole group 7-8 points behind him, Paul, Carson, Bush, Huckabee, and the others on further back. There's only 10% undecided in this poll. That's interesting. And wouldn't you say this is kind of Walker's, he's the closest thing to a neighborhood candidate here, just being from Wisconsin, which is not that far away, and kind of a similar state as far as farm stuff. But the other thing Walker needs to watch out for, this is a caucus state where the most, you know, the most conservative voters show up. That's how a guy like Santorum wins, a guy like Huckabee wins. So, you know, let's keep an eye on Dr. Paul or somebody like that. Who will show up with their committed candidates. And this polling showed that they were the most committed of the committed, if you will. So,
I don't
think it's anybody's race.
Yeah, and it's so tricky because, obviously, if you don't do well, you know, you move over to somebody else's column. So if you really don't have much going on, like Bobby Jindal,
then your delegates are probably going to go elsewhere. There's more. But in some people are going to be more hardcore. If Rand Paul has his father's people, they're going to be a little more stable and stick to him a little further. But it'll just vary. And just so many candidates that it's going to be
state
different.
16 of them right
second
there.
Ballot. Yeah. 16 of them. I mean, and
yeah, that's what was tested.
If you will. So many of them, they're elected and elected. Carly Farinas was even great,
and David, I'm losing you, buddy. I'm losing you. I can't understand
yeah,
a thing you're saying.
I'm sorry, Tim. And get me a little better now.
Yeah, now you're good.
Yeah. Who knows? You know. And luckily, we had good for us the show. But we'll kind of continue to talk about this, and maybe more will come out about this poll during the week, and we can pick it up, you know, in more detail next week.
And we'll see you next week. Good night, sir.
Till then, God be mine.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created...